and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 554. Senator Walker.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be among you again. Senate Bill 554 comes to you from the Senate with one no vote. It simply is a very simple little bill, but I think it's a very important bill. It requires the Department of Human Services to mail notice of intended action regarding general assistance or public assistance at least 30 days before the date of the action. They're supposed to send that notice as soon as possible, but at least 10 days before the date of the action, if the department has been given fewer than 60 days from the legislature. The reason this bill comes to you and came to me is because of all of the cuts that we made in human services, leaving people very, very little notice to access free prescription drug programs or alternative medical services. I thought it was unconscionable that we only gave them 10 days. I will tell you that the emergency board had been asked to do it sooner, and they refused, said they didn't want to cause a panic. Well, we got a panic, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and it was an uncontrolled panic. Federal government guidelines require that we give 10 days notice to people when we're cutting them off of their services. That's the minimum. We can go over the maximum. So that is the purpose of this bill, is to give people 30 days notice, to give them time to find alternative resources.
Okay. Any questions? Senator, thank you. I hope you get feeling better.
Thank you. I went to a health care conference and got sick.
There you go.
That was quite ironic.
Michael?
My snake's fine.
I'm going to reopen as a full committee. So, please go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Michael Buckley. I'm the Administrator for Self-Sufficiency and Training Services for the Department of Human Services. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 554-A. I think, as previously explained, this bill would simply require the department to issue a 30-day notice whenever the department is going to make mass changes in terms of changes to benefit standards that result in either a reduction or termination of public benefits. This is good public policy. What clients need as much time as possible to prepare for any kind of reduction or termination of public benefits. What this bill does not do, it does not change notice requirements when we are taking actions on individual grants. Those are still going to be covered by a 10-day notice. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee?
Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Could you just explain what that last statement meant?
What this bill does, when the department does mass grant reductions, if we're going to reduce standards.
Everybody.
Pardon?
Everybody.
Right, standards that would affect all households. But when individual circumstances change, we will take individual grant actions to reduce benefits due to a change in their circumstance, income, household composition, and those will still be subject to a 10-day notice requirement. I think the only exception to this is when the standards, the mass change where the department has fewer than 60 days, then we may not be able to give a full 30 days, but we'll always try to do 30 days.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 554. Open a work session on Senate Bill 554.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 554 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 554 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll. Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Mm-hmm.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 554.
Should go to the consent calendar, Mr.
President. Is moved to the consent calendar by Representative Tomei. Is there any objections being so ordered? Senate Bill 554, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 554. Can we stand at ease for just a moment? You have amendments? Sandy's out working on that one bill. We'll go to another one. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 74. Colleagues, if you remember, we heard this Monday. We wanted an amendment to put the six-year review back in statute. It's in your packet. That is the dash A4 amendment. So I would entertain a motion on the dash A4.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei moves the dash A4 amendment to Senate Bill 74. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the dash A4 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 74A as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 74A as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Excuse.
Representative
Barker. Aye.
Representative
Dawson. Aye.
Representative
Aye. Representative Weston. Aye. Aye. Senate Bill 74A, having received the constitutional required majority, is declared passed.
They should go in the consent calendar. Oh, this one?
Do you want it there?
Yes.
Representative Dalto does not. So, Representative Dalto will carry.
Okay.
Huh? We adopted day fours, yes.
Thank you.
you object, and that's fair. So we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 74.
Mr. Chair, I think you have to say the full word.
Yes, and Representative, we expect you to pronounce the word.
Phenylalanine?
Yeah, right.
No, we expect it correctly.
The correct pronunciation. I know, it's very easy for me to say.
Okay.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3574. Colleagues, we have a dash 3 amendment. Representative Mona Sanderson, would you speak to those?
Yes. I met with legislative, fiscal, and legislative council to voice the concerns, actually, that the chair had concerns about. And so we had to make some, we have to really get rid of the dash twos that we had adopted before.
The dash ones, wasn't it? It was the dash ones.
That we the ones.
The dash, was it the dash ones?
Yes.
Sent back on the 14th.
Okay.
We have dash two also.
And replace it with the dash threes. And what we were concerned about, well, let's see. Basically what it does is make sure that the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council is not an entity unto itself, but actually is under OECDD. The way we had written it, it means that they were an entity by themselves, and that's not, that wasn't legal, kosher, constitutional, whatever. We also then said that we want to seek funding from the federal government and private sources, and we couldn't have the OTCC do that. It had to be OECDD. And we also needed to have a dollar expenditure limitation in case we do get money, and we needed to have a continuous appropriation account. Don't ask me for too many details, but we'll have assistance. But those were the legalities, and so this will definitely have to go to Ways and Means because of those changes. And it's really pretty clear, and I'm excited. It's going to we are going to be able to have distance learning focus. A plan developed for distance learning for healthcare, and that was the entire intent of this easy bill that became very complicated.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I do have a dash two in my packet. I don't know, did we not act on that? Or
no, we did
okay,
not.
Okay.
So you're moving the
three? Oh, yes. Okay. I will move the dash three amendments to House Bill 3574.
Okay. Representative Mona Anderson moves the dash three amendment to House Bill 3574 with the understanding that this replaces the dash ones.
Is that? Yes.
Are there any objections to the dash threes? Seeing none, the dash threes are adopted. Representative Mona Anderson.
I move House Bill 3574 as amended to the floor with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means and with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Mona Anderson moves House Bill 3574 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. So any discussion?
Mr. Chair, so even though there's just a dollar amount that we're talking about, it still needs to go to Ways and Means.
We could not get over that hurdle.
Okay.
Any other discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Excused.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Dalton.
Aye.
Representative
Watson. Aye.
Representative
May. Aye.
Representative Westland.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3574, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 3574. And open a work session on House Bill 401.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we first heard Senate Bill 401 on the 21st of April. This is the bill that requires the Department of Human Services to implement newborn hearing screening test registry tracking and recall system. At that time, it was the committee's direction to rescind the Ways and Means by prior reference. So it is back before us for committee's consideration. In the meantime, we have also, and should have attached, just received some written testimony from Tammy Phillips, the Oregon Grange Deaf Awareness and Activities Committee Director, just speaking in support of the bill.
And just so the committee knows, the prior reference, nobody's sure why it's there, and it doesn't need to be, so we have permission to rescind that. So what we need is a motion to send this to the floor, also rescinding the prior reference to the Committee on Ways and Means.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 401 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, rescinding the prior reference to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? CNN clerk, call the roll. It's okay.
Aye.
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 Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 401 to the consent calendar.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 401 to the consent calendar. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 401, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 401 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 13. Cindy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 13 is a bill that clarifies the outcome language for the local comprehensive, coordinated comprehensive plans for children and families. It requires the State Commission on Children and Families, Juvenile Crime Prevention Advisory Committee, and the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs to report to the 73rd Legislative Assembly by February 1, 2005. This is a product of a legislative audit committee report that reviewed the comprehensive coordinated plan, had a recommendation, and this legislation is that, and also Sheila, the legislative fiscal officer who works on the, with the audit committee on the report, is here to speak to it also, and the commission's here.
Donna.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Donna Middleton, Director of the State Commission on Children and Families. We have worked with the legislative fiscal around looking at language in the previous Senate Bill 555, which discusses community comprehensive planning. Through the work of community comprehensive planning, we have looked at language around outcomes and in areas of results and best practices. And as a result, the audit committee also looked at that particular language and decided that we would coordinate the language that we use in planning with the language of the Progress Board and the language that's nationally accepted. And so this bill only cleans up the language and the outcome-based information and as required and as asked for by the audit committee.
Sheila.
Good morning, members of the committee. Mr. Chair, Sheila Baker, Legislative Fiscal Office. As Donna said, it cleans up the language so that what's being used as they're working through these local coordinated comprehensive plans is what's in the statute. We had some more vague generic references in the statute prior to that, and we felt that just to avoid confusion, it would be worthwhile to make the statute match what was actually in use in the planning process. I would mention the other piece of this bill on the last page, Section 5, establishes another reporting requirement, or I should say a continuing reporting requirement. One of the things that the Joint Legislative Audit Committee looked at was that this local comprehensive planning was an ongoing operation, and the original statute, Senate Bill 555 from 1999, only required a report back to the legislature through this particular session right now. And so we felt that because this is not a done deal, the plans are a work in progress, it was it would be useful to get a report back to the legislature in the statute for the next session. And frankly, with the budget reductions that we're looking at for the State Commission and for other agencies and the locals that are involved in this, I think it's more important than ever to get a report back and say, well, what has actually been happening in this interim?
Uh-huh. Any questions? Thank you both very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 13. Open a work session on Senate Bill 13. Representative Anderson?
Yes, I'd move that Senate Bill 13 be sent to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson moves Senate Bill 13 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Anderson.
Yes, having had a cousin who had a child born with severe hearing loss and seeing the marvels of what's been done, I think this is an excellent bill.
I think you're on a different bill. You're on a different bill, I think.
Hearing loss?
Yeah, you're that was Senate Bill 401.
This is an actual bill, too.
But this is, but if we delete part of that comment, you're right on target. So.
That was a sales tax measure you voted on earlier. It's a tough morning already.
Yeah, that was a provider assessment for Dennis, buddy.
Could you point me? Okay, that's the next one.
Oh,
is it? Okay.
Any other discussion?
If it's any consolation, Chair Cruz thought we were doing the hearing aid bill, too.
What? Call the roll.
Aye.
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 Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 13 to the consent calendar.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 13 be placed on the consent calendar. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 13, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 13 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 158. We're going out of order just because it's I'm in that sort of mood. Actually, these two bills relate. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 158 again is addressing the Oregon Children and Commission on Children and Families. This one is including community learning centers as part of the services provided in the current children and family system.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I am the Deputy Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. Senate Bill 158, again, just requires some consistency in language. When the founding legislation, House Bill 2004, passed in 1993, which is the Commission's legislation, we had both family resource centers and family service centers in that legislation as a way in which the community could access different kinds of services. In our history since that time, we have many family resource centers. We don't have family service centers. What we do have now are many what we call community learning centers. And a community learning center could be a family resource center. It could be a full service school. It could be a community school. It could be a 21st century community learning center. It could be a lighted school. There are many different names. But what we have now in terms of practice on the ground is that local communities have family resource centers, and as a result of legislation passed last session, which was House Bill 2082, we created the terminology community learning centers that could encompass a variety of ways in which communities chose to provide services to their children and families. So in order to make language consistent, and because we don't have anything that's really called family service centers, we just wanted to take out that terminology and put in community learning centers to make it consistent with our legislation.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The chair is very supportive of this and has been since 99 when we had Dr. Ziegler here to tell us about 21st century school models. Great concept. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 158 and open a work session on Senate Bill 158.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 158 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 158 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk call the roll. Representative Anderson, just a little gun shy.
This is community learning center.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 158
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 158 to the consent calendar.
Okay, Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 158 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 158, having received the required majority, is declared passed. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 158 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 191.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 191 came to us from the Senate with a 27-003 vote. It includes information about benign tumors of the brain and central nervous system in types of conditions included in the statewide registry system, which is housed in the Department of Human Services. It requires clinical laboratories that diagnose cases of cancer or benign tumors of the brain and central nervous system report the information to the statewide registry.
And what's really exciting about this bill, committee members, is that Katie King's going to testify on it.
Mr. Chair, may I be excused to change the air in my spare tire?
You guys are doing really well without coffee this morning.
Good morning, Katie.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Katie King, and I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Liaison for Health Services in the Department of Human Services. And I've submitted written testimony in support of Senate Bill 191, and we also have testimony from a couple of folks that have worked with us on this bill. One is from Dr. Austin, who's a physician and a professor at OHSU and does a lot of work with our cancer registry, and he sits on our advisory committee. And we also have a testimony from the family of a brain tumor survivor. And this bill basically does two things. It adds benign brain tumors to the list of conditions reportable to the Oregon State Cancer Registry, and it also adds clinical labs to the list of facilities required to report those conditions to us. And the Oregon State Cancer Registry was established by the legislature back in 1995 to make it possible for public health practitioners and medical researchers to study patterns of cancer occurrence and look for strategies in regard to prevention, screening, and treatment of cancers and to reduce cancer deaths. We need this bill for a couple of reasons. One, benign brain tumors account for about 40% of brain tumors and can be just as serious as malignant tumors, even causing death. The prognosis and treatment for benign brain tumors is the same as that for malignant tumors. And finally, a federal law passed last October, which requires us to collect this information. So passage of this bill would put us into compliance with federal law. The bill shouldn't be a significant burden to hospitals since reporting mechanisms are already in place, and only a small number of labs would be affected by this change, and some of the labs are already reporting voluntarily. In fact, if this bill does not pass, it would be a problem for us because of HIPAA. They need to have this requirement in statute in order to provide us this information. And we worked with the OMA on some very minor amendments and to the bill, and we asked for your support of those -1 amendments. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Oh. Well, Scott forgot about them anyways. Is that okay?
Yeah, that would be my question, is where are the -1s?
I don't think. Mr. Chairman of the committee, I have not seen any -1 amendments. So if anybody has a copy, we would...
Sandy?
Yes, ma'am?
Sorry, I gave them to you several weeks ago.
Okay.
Sorry.
I have had extensive conversations with Mr. Gallant and Ms. King about the -1s, and I can assure the committee that they are in order and absolutely appropriate.
That would be fine, except that, that I don't see them.
Well...
Scott, do you...
No. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I have is a hand engrossed that changes on page 1, line 24, changes related conditions to benign tumors. Is that what you're...
Mm-hmm.
In two places, that's line 24 and line 25 on page 1. And I believe that's...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what we're trying to do is merely narrow the amount of information that goes to through this process. And that's all these amendments do, make it targeted to the issue at hand. And as has been indicated, the department and OMA believe these are minor changes, but appropriate changes.
Okay, and Scott, just the two corrections on the first page of the bill, that's it?
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I guess I just want to point out that related conditions follows through in the whole bill. So if you're going to change that one on the first page, you probably want to change it throughout the bill, don't you?
That would be logical. You're correct.
I just used an example in the second page, lines 6 and 7.
Okay. Okay. Well, in that case, we will have to bring this back when we get the appropriate amendments.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's on page 3, too.
Yeah. We'll just make sure we... Yeah. If it had just been those two sites, I would have been willing to make LC mad again. But not for something this with this many, many references. So I'm going to close the public hearing on 191, open a public hearing on 606.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 606 authorizes licensed dentists to administer local anesthesia for the purpose of permanent lip coloring and hair removal on the lip area in certain circumstances. This moved off the Senate floor, 23 aye votes, 3 excused, and 4 legislative business. There is no fiscal or revenue impact.
For those of you who have been here long enough, in 99 we had similar legislation stuffed into a House bill on the Senate side, and I think that was... Anyway, that was a fun day on the floor. Go ahead.
I am Sheila Aher, and I'm a past president of the Oregon Association of Licensed Electrologists. I'm an electrologist in Portland, Oregon.
Yes.
Our association comes to you with this on behalf of our members and other non-member electrologists and our clients who are most sensitive in the upper lip area when they have their electrolysis treatments. We've submitted some information that shows you the different areas of the sense organs that are related to pain and heat that are experienced during the treatment to one degree or another. Most of the people who have electrolysis don't necessarily need anything extra, but for those people that have extreme sensitivity or extremely dense hair and a lot to do, maybe men or women, they would appreciate being able to go to their dentist and have an injection. And at one time they could do this. Several years ago when I began working, either their own dentist or a convenient dentist or electrologist could have their client go there and have an injection before coming. And through an interesting situation when a radio DJ asked a dentist to give an injection so he could talk, sort of funny, on his radio program, the Oregon Dental Association put out a little notice in their newsletter, and Representative Anderson may remember this. They were sort of admonished, not to do anything except for dental procedures. And so it wasn't, though it's not part of the dental practices bill, it was just sort of, it sort of come down along the line so that they can no longer do that for us or will not. So we would like to have this clarified, and it would be very helpful if they could, again, use their skills to help people who are in need could be more comfortable during our treatment. And we know that this request was also asked 2 years ago at the very end of the session for the purpose of permanent makeup for the lips. And we do have a number of topicals that people can benefit from. Unfortunately, not everyone can get them. Some formularies for certain HMOs eliminate the possibility that they can get those. Right now, there's a certain prescriptive one that is just impossible to buy because of a packaging problem they have. We have some over-the-counter things that work. But for some people, it's just not quite enough. So we would like to clarify this so that dentists would know where they could do this for their own patients as well as anyone coming in. And it also sets up a much better situation than before when people would just kind of go in, you know, casually to a dentist to get a shot, because there are certain record-keeping requirements involved in this, which is much beneficial. I had a client a long time ago go for a shot and had some heart palpitations because of the epinephrine in the shot. They called to the dentist. They didn't keep a history of this person. He wasn't a client. They didn't remember exactly what they gave her, so she was very worried that her next dental appointment she might have the same problem. But this requires the dentist to do a brief exam and make records. You know, so I think it's beneficial for the client, and it also is a safeguard for the dentist, and it would be just very nice if we could do this.
Wasn't the last bill just retired dentists? It wasn't? Okay. Just trying to give you some business.
Did you say retarded?
Please go ahead.
Good morning, Chairman Cruz and members of the committee. My name is Jamie Bloom, and I am now the president of the Oregon Association of Licensed Electrologists. I am also the chairperson for the Health Advisory Council for Electrology, Tattooists, and Permanent Makeup Technicians. I've been an electrologist in Oregon for 15 years and 5 years in New York, in case you hear my accent. I represent all the electrologists in Oregon, as we do many handicapped people who cannot shave because of various handicaps, and so this way we can alleviate the hair on their upper lip, men and women. And a lot of these people, because the hair is so coarse and thick and the upper lip is a very tender situation, they really could use the benefit of an injectable Novocaine so that their treatments could be better and we can help them. We also treat many, many TSs or transsexuals. And these people also, again, very thick, coarse hairs. I'm sure at least four of you shave every morning. And you know that the hair is coarse, and this injection would help us treat them so that they can be the person they want to be. Do you have any questions that
I can
possibly answer?
Just out of interest, how long are the procedures that you would need the length of?
All right. When I'm doing a transsexual, the upper lip can take me an hour. And they, you know, after a while, just the nerves start frying out, and they just need this extra compensation. The topical anesthetics usually last maybe 10, 15 minutes if they last that long. Some of them are better than others. Some people, even with the topical anesthetics, it just isn't enough so that we can treat them correctly. If we don't put enough heat in, then the procedure that we're doing takes much longer. The optimum treatment is to use the most amount of heat so that we can basically cauterize the hair follicle, the papilla, which is the blood vessel that nourishes the hair, and so it doesn't grow back. But if we don't put in enough heat, then they have to return for more and more treatments. We're not asking for a new bill. The bill states right now, the format states right now that dentists can do this for tattooing, and all we want is to be added onto that so that it could be tattooing and electrolysis.
Yes.
The only concern I had was the length of time. If it's only an hour, that's not a major problem. But considering the time the dental office, travel to your office, procedure, a normal anesthetic could do fine for an hour, hour and a half, but there are long-acting Marcaine and several others that would give you 6 hours. That'd be plenty to cover the whole.
Oh, more than enough. Dr. Alan Montrost used to administer these Novocaines for me, and his office is about a half hour from my office, and we had no problem. It always lasted long enough to complete.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, just for the record, my name is John Christensen. I'm a staff person in the office of State Senator Margaret Carter. She requests your consideration for the bill. She's on the Senate floor at the current time, and this constituent bill, she's supportive of it, and thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Folks, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 606 and open a work session on Senate Bill 606.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 606 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 606 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye.
Consent calendar. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move that we place this bill on the consent calendar.
Okay.
He learns fast.
Well, I was looking at him. He probably figured. Representative Dalton moves that Senate Bill 606 be placed on the consent calendar. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 606, having received the required majority, is declared passed. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 606. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 155. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 155 modifies the licensing authority of the State Board of Psychologist Examiners. It does have a prior reference to Ways and Means, and there is a dash one amendment attached to your materials, which will be spoken to in the testimony. And I will be passing out testimony from the Psychologist Examiners Board.
Okay. David, Peter, and Susan.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and distinguished representatives of the committee. My name is Dr. David C. Wade. I'm a licensed psychologist. I work out of Hood River for Providence Course Counseling and Treatment Services. And I'm here to talk in support of the Dash 1 Amendment of Senate Bill 155. And I guess I'd like to start off by kind of giving you the bottom line first, which is we don't have enough psychiatrists, in my opinion, to meet the needs of the people in our state. And if we did, frankly, I wouldn't be here this morning. Having worked with a number of populations, children as well as adults, and working in a rural community, what I've found is that there are a number of clients, unfortunately, that do not get the medical care they need in a timely manner. Currently, at the clinic that I work at, we have a psychiatrist. If one was to call up today and try and get an appointment with her, they would get in sometime in August. Likewise, once they got in, it would probably take a month for a follow-up visit after the initial visit. And this has been a chronic problem. There have been times when Hood River actually has had no psychiatrists, and consequently, what we have is primary care practitioners trying to meet the needs of these patients. And when I say primary care practitioners, I'm talking about MDs, I'm talking about nurse practitioners and physician assistants. And some of the problems with this are that some of these folks are put in a very difficult situation, having limited amounts of time to see patients with managed care, and some have very limited training and expertise in treating mental health conditions. This can put them in a real bind. If they have a patient come in who, let's say, is suicidal and not doing well, and they're unable to get this person into a hospital, then they feel like they need to treat this with a medication. So some of the things that they try to do is consult. I know a number of primary care practitioners who will call up master's level psychotherapists and ask them, well, what medication should I give this person and how much? And I think that the primary care practitioners are put between a rock and a hard place, because obviously you're going to try the best to treat your patient. Now the other question might be, well, what about hospitalization? Well, in the Gorge, looking at Hood River, the Dalles, and even across the river, we have no psychiatric beds, which means if we have people with serious mental health conditions, they cannot stay there. So consequently, that means, okay, can we get them to Portland? Can we get them to Pendleton? And the things that we run up there against are, well, do they have insurance? We have a number of people who are unemployed who don't have insurance. We have Oregon Health Plan that's quickly dwindling away. And then we also have a lack of beds. So we have problems there. Also, I think living in a rural community, we have difficulties of transportation and so forth also in terms of getting into the larger cities. And so I think that we're managing a larger population probably of people on an outpatient basis, and oftentimes they need to have the benefit of psychotropic medications. Other situations that have come up that I've experienced that I think are important to bring up are, I had a case where I'd been treating a woman for quite some time who was on a medication called Effexor, which is an antidepressant. And she called me up one day, and she was very agitated. She said she hadn't been sleeping in days. She was having night sweats. She said, I think I'm going crazy, and she was very upset. And I asked her about her medication, and she informed me that she had not taken this Effexor for almost a week now. Well, there's a thing called the discontinuation syndrome sometimes when people just stop their medications, which can result in pretty extreme symptoms. So what I did was and then she said, well, but it's not a problem because I started taking my medication again. Well, she started back at 300 milligrams, which is a pretty hefty dose, and you don't just start at that dose because if you do, you're going to get side effects and you're going to have problems. Well, I couldn't tell her how to take her medication because that would be practicing medicine. So I called up the psychiatrist. Well, the psychiatrist was not available, and this was County Mental Health, and so I said, well, who's on call? And so they put me talking with a master's level therapist. And I said, you know, I'm not willing to have my patient, you know, talk with you about this because you're not in a position to be given medical advice. So consequently, I called up her primary care physician. The primary care physician was not available. They were not on call. So I called up the person backing up the primary care physician, explained my situation, explained my concerns, what we could do. And this person, this practitioner said, you know, gosh, I'd like to help you, but I don't know anything about this patient. I don't know anything about Effexor. I'm really uncomfortable doing this. So consequently, I'm talking to the patient. I'm trying to get her to go to the ER, but she was too anxious to do that, and she didn't go to the ER. But this is just one example of the kinds of things that happen on a regular basis in a rural community and not having adequate psychiatric care. And again, I work with a lot of primary care practitioners. A number of them do a great job. I think that they do their best. But again, I run into lots of problems like that. And another thing with kids, I do a lot of work with children, and I'll have children sometimes come in on Ritalin, and I assess them, and they're not ADHD. Their family's all out of whack. You know, they have a lot of problems going on, but the child really is not doesn't have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Consequently, they're being medicated, and they're on the wrong medication. And again, I think that practitioners are trying to do their best job. They come in, they have a short period of time. Parent says, my kid's off the wall, he's not studying, he's having a difficult time. And so it's like, well, let's try a little Ritalin. Now, I think Ritalin's a very useful drug in the right circumstances, but this is the kind of thing that I see. Likewise, I've had children who are dangerous. Parents are locking their doors, barricading the doors because they're afraid that their children are going to kill them at night, can't find a hospital bed, and the practitioner is not wanting to try certain kinds of medications because it's out of their scope. So hence we come back to, well, they get on the waiting list for the psychiatrist. So I could, you know, I could give you numerous accounts like this, but these are just a few that I wanted to share that are not atypical. These are things that I see on a regular basis. And I strongly believe that, you know, psychologists who have specialized training, one of the nice things is when I see a client, I get to see them 50 to 60 minutes at a shot. So I get more time for assessment. And when you're treating somebody with medication, you're educating them about side effects. You're monitoring side effects. And there are a number of conditions such as depression and anxiety that the literature will say a combination of medication and psychotherapy is the most useful. And so I think that psychologists, if they have the proper training, are really in a very unique position to monitor this very closely. Now, psychiatrists could do the same thing, but my concern is, frankly, that we don't have enough psychiatrists. And I've talked to a number of colleagues in metropolitan areas as well, and they say the same thing. So kind of to wrap things up, I think that if we have psychologists prescribing medications who are adequately trained, I think Oregonians are going to get better services. There's going to be increased availability of full mental health services. I think we're going to have more support to the primary care practitioners because they're going to be able to refer to us to administer these medications. And I also think that we're going to save a lot of money. I think we're going to save the client money by having fewer practitioners that they need to go to, fewer appointments that they need to do. Also, if we can maintain people out of the hospital, that saves thousands of dollars, and not only in the private sector, but I think that it saves thousands of dollars in the public sector and looking at state funds and so forth, because we're managing these folks on an outpatient basis. So in conclusion, I am very much in support of this. Like I say, I wouldn't be here if I didn't feel that there was an urgent need, and I really hope that you will support the -1 amendment of Senate Bill 155. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you. My name is...
No, Mr. Chair, yeah. I'm just going to add, maybe this is too early in the thing. I was wanting to know about the training that's required for that, but maybe I should wait till you're
Dr. Patch and I know will
okay.
be.
Thank you.
Members of the committee, Chairman Cruz, my name is Peter Grover. I'm a psychologist licensed to practice in the state of Oregon. I'm here to speak in support of the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 151, which I feel like provides a substantial opportunity to improve the mental health care of the citizens of Oregon. My day job, I work as the clinical supervisor for the adult psychiatric unit at Providence Hospital in Portland, and I also have a small private practice that I conduct as well. And Dr. Wade here has talked about the problems in rural Oregon. Unfortunately, they're not much better even in the big city. A typical situation on our psychiatric unit is our social workers who are trying to plan follow-up outpatient care for people with serious destabilization of their mental illness who may have suffered a recent lethal overdose. They're also trying to get psychiatry appointments that are 3 to 6 weeks out. They can get an emergency crisis appointment sometimes within 10 days. A typical person who's trying to get care like that coming out of the hospital is someone like Susan, who's a 52-year-old woman with a long history of schizophrenia. And she, fortunately, she gets Social Security disability payments of $1,700 a month. Unfortunately, that puts her over income for standard coverage under Oregon Health Plan. So she received a letter from her community mental health clinic in March stating they could no longer provide her psychiatry services, they could no longer provide her supportive case management, and they could no longer provide her supportive group therapies that help her stay stable. And in the letter, they told her to go to her primary care physician to get continued care for her psychiatric problem. Within a few weeks, she fell apart, and without all that supportive care, took a nearly lethal overdose, spent a few days in the ICU, and then came to our psychiatric unit for acute stabilization. So this is a woman who has a lot of problems. By the way, she also has congestive heart failure and diabetes. So this woman's a train wreck, and she needs intensive specialized treatment to get her back on track. And when my psychologist colleagues were asking me, I had talked for years about the possibility of prescribing privileges, I frankly was against it. I said, no way. I work in a setting where every day I see train wrecks like Susan, and there's no way that I could ever take on the responsibility of treating someone like that with a serious psychiatric problem, multiple medical conditions, and she's on 5 psychiatric medications in addition to several medical medications. So there's no way I could help someone like that. Susan needs a specialist. She needs a train wreck specialist. And the psychiatrists in our unit are train wreck specialists. And in trying to get follow-up care for Susan, she needs the slot with that psychiatrist in 3 weeks, which is the soonest appointment she could get. She needs the slot with that psychiatrist. In contrast, someone in my private practice, Robert, he's 35 years old. He's been depressed for 6 months. He went to his primary care doc and got Prozac when he first started. But then 2 months ago, he started the process of going through a divorce, and the Prozac wasn't enough for him. His primary care doc was great. He sent her to me and said, you need some therapy to help you get through this. But that medication wasn't enough to help him. Now he goes to work, sits there, stares at his desk, can't get through the workday. His boss has told him he's falling down on the job and he might lose it. So he needs something quickly now to get him back on his feet. So when my psychologist colleague said, no, you can't handle the train wrecks, but couldn't you consult with a primary care physician to help them better treat the people in their office, I said, no problem. With the stuff I do every day on the psychiatric unit, with some additional training experience, I could help someone like Robert. So to me, what this is all about is who gets that appointment with the train wreck specialist? Does Susan get it or does Robert get it? Because I'm calling on the phone because I know that train wreck specialist myself, saying, can you get my patient in? Because his primary care physician is saying he needs more help than I can offer. The social worker in the psych unit wants to get Susan into that appointment. If I had the scope of practice granted to me by the Board of Psychologist Examiners, I could see Robert, and Susan could go to the train wreck specialist. Everyone would be better served. That's all I got. Thanks.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm Dr. Susan Patchen. I am the legislative chair for the Oregon Psychological Association and would like to speak to the particulars of the bill, the Dash 1 amendment. There are 3 parts to what we are asking for. The first is the education. To begin with, psychologists are already doctors. We have a bachelor's degree, which averages 4 years. We have a master's degree, which averages another 2, and then 5 years in our doctoral programs with an additional 2 years of supervised practice. This is a postdoctoral proposal where you would have to get an additional amount of training. What I've brought for you is a brochure. This is the program that's currently being offered in the state of Oregon and is the program that all 3 of us have attended. It is actually 385 hours. We have asked in this bill for 300 hours. If you look, you can see on page 8 and 9 the coursework that we've gone through. We've had neuroscience, neuroanatomy, neurophysiology, pathophysiology, pharmacology, clinical pharmacology, psychopharmacology. We do special populations. We get work in chemical dependence, in physical and laboratory, and in psychopharmatherapeutics. So it's quite an extensive program that we go through while we already have our doctorates, while we are already licensed and are in practice. In addition, there is supervised practice that is required where we are supervised by a medical provider, by a physician. And I have actually had no problems working with primary care physicians in my community. They learn from me because I can bring them up-to-date information more than what they get from their drug reps. And we work together to make plans for our patients that we share. The last part is a national examination. There is a national exam that exists that we would be required to pass and then would be allowed to seek this licensure in psychopharmacology as what they would call a prescribing psychologist. Also provided for you testimony from Dr. Russ Newman, who is from the American Psychological Association, and from Dr. Lieutenant Colonel Elaine Mantel, who is one of the Department of Defense psychopharmacology demonstration project psychologists, where she describes her training, her skills, the work that she is currently doing. She is currently a prescribing psychologist. And as she says in the last sentence of her testimony, the PDP graduates have already proven with at least 10 years of safe prescribing that psychologists may learn to prescribe safely and effectively. So we do have a track record with our Department of Defense psychologists that we can learn how to do this. Oregon has already granted two other non-physician prescribers, such as dentists, podiatrists, nurse practitioners, and physician's assistants, the ability to prescribe limited formularies. That is what we are asking. This would not be for every psychologist. This would be for psychologists that would choose it. Both David and I are in rural areas. We do have other psychologists currently in the program, and we have many, many inquiries. I believe that as we started our program last year, we had 50 inquiries, and most of them are from rural areas. People are interested in serving people that need help. I'm 35 miles from Portland, and as David said, to get into a psychiatrist, I needed to get a psychiatrist for a child, and I made 11 phone calls before I even found somebody who had a waiting list that was available, and at that point, it was a 14-week wait. Not too long ago, I had an adult who was sent to my office by his primary care physician in our community who was actively psychotic at that point and couldn't understand why people would not give him his health tags. He was carrying his gun with him as he came to my office in an acute psychotic problem. We couldn't get him into anybody. Even though he was obviously a danger to himself at that point, carrying around this gun, very angry that he was not able to go elk hunting. What we were able to do is I know these physicians. These are physicians that I work with. They know that I have had this training. I was able to talk to and work with his primary care physician to get him on correct medication at the correct dose. Medication that general practitioners have a very difficult time keeping up with by his own doctor's admission, and then we could get him stabilized and seen 12 weeks later by a local psychiatrist. So there is a need. I believe that psychologists trained to prescribe will provide integrated psychological and pharmacological care with an in-depth understanding of their patient, which will allow both close monitoring of the medication and the overall treatment. And so we will not only save money, but I think we're going to save lives.
Thank you for hearing us.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Dr. Patchen?
Patchen.
On page 5, or section 5, page 2, it says that the council will determine the substances that will be in the formulary. Tell me how that will happen.
Okay. As you see in that section 5, we have set up a system of a formulary council similar to what other providers have. This will have a, they will help choose the medications that we can administer. As you see, they're from several different disciplines. We have psychologists, we have pharmacists, we have physicians, and we have public members. And so they will provide the list of medications similar to what nurse practitioners, but it will be for medications that treat mental disorders. That is what we are asking for, mental and nervous disorders. And we would like the expertise of as many kinds of practitioners as possible, which is why we chose this method of formulary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are most of your patients in any physical pain, or many of your patients? I'm asking in regards to the controlled substance.
In terms of chronic pain. And that, to me, is one of those lines. In my private practice, I see very few people with chronic pain, and it's the train wreck inpatients who I feel like need specialized care from psychiatry that are typically dealing with chronic pain issues. I don't know if we've, if Dr. Patchen wants to speak, if we have a clear stance on controlled substances and how that would be managed.
In general, we are part of the pain commission group that has been set up. Psychologists are part of that. Psychologists do treat chronic pain. That is not the focus necessarily of this. It's for medications such as stimulants that work with children, those kinds of things. There are a few medications that fall into that category, which is why we've considered all of those as part of the formulary.
Could I just add something there? Because I have a number of people who have chronic pain, and for myself, even if I was able to prescribe, I would still be referring them to the pain clinic and networking with specialists in that area, and that's one of the things that I think psychologists typically do a real good job of is working with other professionals to provide continuity of care.
Any other questions? Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you think that the lithium would be in your formulary?
I do believe that we have been trained to administer this as well as other mood stabilizers.
Okay. And usually when someone starts out on lithium, you need to have their blood drawn to check their levels. And I thought that psychologists aren't able to interpret lab results so that you can monitor the amount of lithium until you get the stable dose. Could you address that issue?
Sure. The psychologist model of prescribing is a more holistic model. Just in general, when we see patients now, we collaborate with their primary care physicians. So that is a communication that we already have open. Lithium is not necessarily the first medication that would be given for example, bipolar disorder. But if that kind of monitoring was necessary, as it is with lithium, we have been trained. Our whole lab portion and physical assessment portion helped us to understand, and we've learned about lab tests. We would need a physician to order that, and that is the kind of collaboration that we would have with physicians.
But yeah, the physician's office would order and obtain the laboratory information. We'd collaborate with the primary care physician on interpreting that information and adjusting the dosage appropriately.
Okay. Also, there are some diseases that you may think that they're a mental or emotional problem, but they may be something else. And, I have a concern about misdiagnosis without maybe, I was wondering, why couldn't you just become a nurse practitioner? For those who want to do it, become a nurse practitioner, too, and then you're totally covered, and you would have the whole be able to treat the whole physical as well as mental.
That would be good. Then I'd be a nurse instead of a psychologist, but
I'd just be
two different professionals instead of one. And we did receive extensive training in medical conditions that present with psychological symptoms. And then, again, we'd also be anyone that we work with would be also seeing their primary care physician, who would be working them up for medical conditions while we're working up their psychological conditions, and we collaborate about appropriate medications.
I'd like to add, too, currently, when I see people come in for depression, for example, I ask, when have you had your last physical? Have you had a recent blood workup? Assessing for diabetes and a thyroid condition, because those are a couple of those medical conditions that can appear to be depression and actually can evolve into depression. And so I think in that regard, people would continue to collaborate, because, again, for myself, I want to treat the mental health condition. I'm not trying to become a physician. I don't want to treat all these other conditions. That's where I'm going to collaborate. And I think the aspect of physical health is extremely important when we're dealing with mental health problems.
And additionally, if most of the psychiatrists that I work with, it's been a long time since they've given a physical exam, and they coordinate with primary care physicians in ruling out serious physical illnesses. So the standard of care is similar.
Oh, just one little follow-up. I agree that there is a real issue with access for those with mental disorders. I have no question about those who would be seen a psychologist and then all of a sudden realize that they really needed to have some medication, and they'd have to go to a psychiatrist to get a proper diagnosis, et cetera. I don't have a problem with that. I'm just... don't have enough experience here with whether the training is adequate.
And I think that it's important to have concerns about safety as we go ahead with this. Psychologists in developing this program have done this with safety in mind and tried to ensure in working with other groups of professionals that we're getting adequate training to keep people safe. And I encourage you to, as you consider this, ask everyone involved about safety and how it's being managed. It's really important.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm state representative from District 11, and I'm here to talk about the Dash Ones. I've also presented two other amendments to the bill, which, if I may, I'd prefer to talk about separately because I think these are quite separate issues. I want to back off to the 64,000-foot level or the 30,000-foot level for a moment in dealing with this bill. I think the previous witnesses have done a very good job of outlining the issues on a practical level and the kinds of concerns, I think, that generally come up in this area. And I wanted to remind the committee that in the last session, one of the bills that came forward, which I actually carried when I was a member of the committee, had to do with the optometrist's use of medications. And the issues that came up and the concerns that the committee had, which were finally dealt with and which resulted in the passage of that bill, involved, I think, several basic components. First, that there's a need for the expansion of the professions role in the treatment of patients. I think that's been well established here. I can tell you in my own experience, which is now several years old, it's often extremely difficult to get psychiatric care for children and adequate care when behavioral issues come up for children. And it's not unusual, I think, for ADHD and other disorders to be misdiagnosed in the context of primary care physicians' offices. They're busy, they have a lot of other things to do, and this is a difficult area of practice. I can tell you in my own training in dealing with psychiatric and psychological diagnoses that many times the psychologists are the ones who actually are able to determine what the accurate differential diagnosis is in situations involving mental disorders. That's not to say that we don't work in the context of a wide team of providers to understand what's going on with a person who's acting unusually. But often in that team, the psychologists are the ones who actually come to understand what the problem is. I think the need in Oregon is, I think, quite clear, and I think that's been demonstrated. Another issue that we dealt with in the optometry bill, and which is crucial to something like this, is the issue of training. You'll note that we're talking here in the proposed amendment, not about licensing all psychologists to become prescribing psychologists, but only a subset who actually go through a fairly rigorous training program. Dr. Patchen said 300 hours. The bill actually says 350 hours of training in the areas indicated, with supervision. By people who are already qualified in these areas, and with a national examination, and completing any other requirements established by the board. I should let you know that this is not something that's been made up in Oregon. This is a national standard. It's currently used in the training of prescribing psychologists in the military. We've had at least a decade of experience in the military with prescribing psychologists, and it works extremely well. Prescribing psychologists tend to behave somewhat differently than psychiatrists because their background is different, and that tends to be useful in the adequate diagnosis and treatment of mental and emotional disorders. I've already mentioned experience under supervision and which I think is another component necessary, and national standards. Even though this is relatively new in terms of state certification, it's only been done in one other state up to this point, to my knowledge. This doesn't come out of the air. It comes from evolving national standards, which have been in existence for some time, and as I've pointed out, have been in use in the military for some time. I believe that that this bill is ripe, or this amendment is ripe, and it can go forward. I think we've dealt with all the major issues, and I'm prepared to answer questions on it. And then I'd like to talk about a different topic, if that's okay with the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there other states that have allowed psychologists to have prescriptive privileges?
Yes, New Mexico has adopted a law similar to this one. I'm not familiar with the details of it. I expect it will happen in other states as well, because this is not just a movement in Oregon. This is a national response to the needs that the other panel, I think, pretty eloquently described.
When you go to the dash two,
other topic, dash twos and dash threes, they're really the same amendment. The dash twos stand alone. The dash threes are a combination of the dash ones and the dash twos. In the last few days, an issue has arisen for me that is completely separate from this, and that has to do with the way in which psychologists administer psychological tests. One of the areas of psychological practice which distinguishes it from the practices of other mental health professionals are the administration of psychological tests, administration, scoring, and interpretation of psychological tests. In the practice of neuropsychology, which is basically the understanding of brain behavior as it relates to behavioral components in a person's life, it is a normal practice of neuropsychology to evaluate individuals who have demonstrated some difficulty with brain function for the purpose of determining how they're able to function normally within the context of society and what their limitations are. This is a part of the normal practice of psychology and is used in a number of ways to assist in other people making decisions. For example, whether or not a person is unable to work under the Social Security Act and therefore should be given some disability payments for the purpose of rehabilitation after a closed head injury or an open head injury in an automobile accident. What kinds of difficulties does this person have in specifics, and therefore what kinds of treatment should that person have?
Okay.
These batteries of tests often involve 10 or 12 hours of testing. Many of these tests can and are routinely administered by psychological technicians who are trained in the administration of these tests and in the scoring of them. Basically, we're talking about pencil and paper personality tests, or about intelligence tests, the administration of which is very tightly regulated by the administration manual. You do it right, you have good results that you can compare to other people. You do it incorrectly, and you have garbage. So it's important to do these things right. But it isn't required ethically for a psychologist to actually administer or score these particular kinds of instruments. That can be done by a psychological technician under the supervision of a psychologist. And it is routinely done around the country that way. It's been done that way for many years. There is a lot of literature in the field defining how it's to be done, what kind of training psychological technicians need, and what's ethical to be done. And psychologists who are held ethically to doing it the way in which these have been done have come to be understood. In Oregon, in the last few months, the Board of Psychology Examiners has decided to interpret the Practice Act to mean that only psychologists can administer psychological tests, in spite of this wide variety of literature, and in spite of the fact that the Oregon law is very similar to the law in many other states in which psychological tests are routinely administered by psych techs under the supervision of psychologists. This amendment, Amendment 2-2, adds one sentence to the Practice Act, which makes it clear to the board that psychologists can use qualified technicians under their supervision to administer and score psychological tests. Notice I did not include in that interpretation of psychological tests. That is very clearly solely within the purview of the psychologist and must be done by the psychologist. But it's perfectly appropriate, normal, and correct practice in every state except Oregon now for a neuropsychologist to delegate the administration and scoring of many psychological test instruments to psych techs, and that's what this amendment restores. I personally believe, and I'll just pass this along for what it's worth, that the board has erred in its interpretation of the statute, that it needs to go back and rewrite the administrative rules, that it has the authority under the Current Practice Act to do what it needs to do, but it is disrupting psychological practice with the current rule, which has the effect of grossly increasing the cost of these kinds of evaluations and reducing their availability for especially poor people who need them for the purpose of determining a variety of things around their mental capacities and mental states. I hope I've summarized that well.
Questions?
Will we hear from the board?
Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, sir.
Teresa Shelby and John McCauley.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCauley, here representing the Oregon Psychiatric Association. I'm not going to say we're supporting the Dash 1 amendments in case anybody thinks we're going to go that way. We're opposed to the Dash 1 amendments to this bill. And I will briefly describe what I'm handing out to you, and then Dr. Shelby will present testimony on behalf of the Oregon Psychiatric Association. One of the issues you've heard about is access, and I think we have to acknowledge that access to appropriate care for mental disorders is an issue in the state that we need to address. And we believe that there are better ways to address that than allowing non-medical people to prescribe psychotropic medications. Attached to my testimony is a spreadsheet of the location of various people in the state who can prescribe medications. And I just present that to you so you can note city by city and county by county in the state that psychologists tend to congregate the same places all others in the state tend to congregate, and that's in the more populated areas. And we believe that there are ways to address issues of access in rural areas beyond allowing psychologists to prescribe medications. We do have psychiatrists who are circuit riders who will go to Lake County and Harney County and be present there to meet people's needs. You saw some very dramatic information this session on telemedicine. That is a growing area that also is involving psychiatry. I also need to mention two other things that are happening right now and have been going on for quite a while. OHSU has a consult line for all of its specialties, including psychiatry, that primary care physicians can access. Our own organization, the Oregon Psychiatric Association, for the past 15 years has had a referral line. We have more than 60 psychiatrists who are accepting new patients who are part of that referral system. We get 3 to 4 calls a day from members of the public, from primary care doctors, from family members who are looking for help, and we're able to provide that. So there are ways to address the access issue. I also want to very briefly comment on the New Mexico situation in response to Representative Mona Anderson's question. It is true that New Mexico is the only state in the United States that has passed legislation in this area. But it is also true that it is unlike the Dash 1 amendments that are before you. The New Mexico legislation involved a significant role for the Board of Medical Examiners in that state. And it's my understanding that as of today, that even though that legislation passed more than a year ago, it has still not been implemented because of disagreements over the training program that is occurring or needs to occur there. And as a result, no psychologists are yet prescribing in New Mexico. There are psychologists prescribing psychotropic medications in Oregon. I think it's important to note that. that psychologists who have completed a nurse practitioner's curriculum are today prescribing medications. So it is possible for psychologists to do what they want to do with appropriate medical training. Mr. Chair, with that, I'd like to have Dr. Shelby present her testimony.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be brief. Professionally, I'm a practicing child psychiatrist in Beaverton. The Oregon Psychiatric Association is very strongly opposed to prescribing of medications by psychologists. A psychologist has a doctoral degree in psychology, which is a social science, and with all due respect, this does not prepare one for the prescribing of medication. A psychiatrist is a fully trained physician who specializes in psychiatry. The educational pathway for that is quite long, beginning with a rigorous curriculum of science courses in college, then 4 years of medical school, then a year of internship, which is an in vivo clinical experience with general medicine and neurology as well as psychiatry, and then 3 to 4 years of psychiatric residency. Prescribing medication is complex and dangerous. Psychotropic medications can affect any system of the body as well as the brain. Psychotropic medications can interact with other medications the patient may be taking for other medical conditions, such as high blood pressure, heart disease, diabetes, many other conditions. We believe that comprehensive medical training pertaining to the body as a whole is necessary to understand and monitor the effects of psychotropic medication, and that it is not possible to compress this extensive body of knowledge into an abbreviated curriculum. Currently, there is a very significant problem in Oregon relating to access to mental health care. This is related more to the current economic conditions, Oregon health plan cuts, and the large number of uninsured people than it is to a lack of practitioners. Psychologists prescribing won't solve this problem. We also believe that psychologists prescribing is not the answer to rural access problems. The great majority of psychologists live and work in the urban areas in the western part of the state, as you can see in your handout. In cases where a psychiatrist is not available, we believe the best alternative is a primary care physician who would be an individual who has the same or more general medical training as we do. Currently, it's a major focus of the Oregon Psychiatric Association to maximize the availability of psychiatrists to assist and to consult with primary care physicians regarding their psychiatric patients. As a child psychiatrist, I am even more particularly concerned about the prospect of poorly trained psychologists prescribing medications for children. I prefer to be in my office this morning treating a few children, but I'm here because I think this is a compelling issue of public safety. Sometimes when you watch a person who is expert doing something, you think, oh, that's easy, I could do it. But you think that because you don't know all the steps and dangers and pitfalls. And then when you become in that position, you see that it's another matter altogether. I urge you not to support this proposal. Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, if I might add one more thing. I forgot to refer to another attachment in my testimony. I think it's important to note that there is pretty significant disagreement within the psychological community about this initiative. And I've attached some articles, summaries of articles. I have the complete articles if you would like to look at them, from psychologists who are expressing some severe reservations about giving this privilege to their profession.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to get back to the access issue because so many of our children are being seen by psychologists and really do need to have medication, and it is difficult to get in to see even a primary physician, let alone a psychiatrist. And in many of these cases, the primary physician would probably refer them to a psychiatrist. I would think. I'm just having an issue with how I think I heard what Dr. Shelby was saying, that you feel a psychologist should have a relationship with a primary care physician and work with the primary care physician, when in most cases I would think the primary physician would probably refer to a psychiatrist.
What I was saying is that where a psychiatrist is not immediately available, and someone's going to prescribe medication, I'm generally very comfortable with primary care physicians do that because they do have comprehensive medical training in the total body, and many of them do that very well. Some don't, and we're committed to working with them and to being available by consultation, and we're working on ways to make that better. I agree it is a problem, but I would much rather have that done in the hands of a physician. And psychologists and primary care doctors do work together. Psychologists and psychiatrists work together and team up, and there's many combinations that work very well.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Connie and Peggy.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I'm Connie Powell. I'm a psychiatrist in private practice in Portland and a past president of the Oregon Psychiatric Association and immediate past president of the Oregon Medical Association. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association, which represents over 6,800 physicians in the state. Mental illness is among the most common types of medical illnesses. About 1 in 5 Oregonians gets a mental illness when you consider the range of them. In fact, it's highly unlikely that there's someone in this room who hasn't at some point experienced a depression or some other form of mental illness, which may not have been severe enough to require treatment, but a number of people do. These illnesses are among the common disorders treated by primary care physicians. Primary care physicians prescribe 70% of psychiatric disorders because all illnesses that are serious enough to require treatment, but not so severe or unusual in their symptom or manifestations that they require expert treatment, are within the normal practice of primary care. That primary care physicians say about 1/4 of the literature on their discipline says about 1/4 of their patients are there for a mental illness diagnosis. Now, the patient goes to the doctor with a list of symptoms, and then the doctor evaluates in the context of the differential or total list of medical conditions that can present with that list of complaints. So all the patient's required to do is talk about having trouble with sleep, having trouble with appetite, and it's the listener, the physician, who's supposed to sort out of the range of things that could be, which ones it's likely to be or which smaller list it's likely to be that requires further tests to figure out which one it is exactly. So the physician expertise leads him or her to conduct a physical examination and then any other tests, including laboratory tests, that would help the physician determine if the patient's symptoms are because of a specific mental illness or if they are the result of another medical condition. We don't require the patient to know that ahead of time and figure out which specialist to go to. They need an overall general determination of that. The medical evaluation...
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to get back to the medications again. You said that a primary care physician, 70% of the medications they prescribe are mental
health. No, 70% of mental health medications are prescribed by primary care physicians.
Okay.
Yeah. We haven't gotten to the reverse yet, but, you know, things keep going this way in Oregon. We're going to all need these. Okay, so the medical evaluation is essential, and I'm saying for public safety. So, for example, symptoms of psychosis can be associated with schizophrenia, which is a mental health diagnosis. These symptoms can also be associated with over-medication. It's a side effect, or medication interactions, metabolic disorders, which require an analysis of blood screening panels to determine which ones those might be, forms of cancer, and developing dementias. What part of this is possibly mental health? What part of this is an underlying organic problem that needs a different kind of treatment path? This is a sophisticated set of decisions that the primary care physician is making while just appearing to sit there in conversation. It's what's going on in the background while he's chatting. The symptoms of depression, a more common disorder, can be associated also with a range of conditions that require medical treatment. Depression's associated, it's one of the symptoms of a thyroid problem, anemia, blood problems that are associated with weakness and fatigue, the kinds of things that are on the list of depressive symptoms. Developing cancers often present with a patient feeling more depressed or more anxious, and looking into that with a more thorough examination determines that there is some change in their actual physical health that is related to the way they're feeling. So it's like a signal that involves further looking into. So the primary care physician, if a patient says, I'm depressed, doesn't just take that at face value. It just signals that there is a need for evaluation of this patient that is multidimensional, and it could be the patient's right, he saw it on television and he has it, or it could be that he's just having those symptoms and it's really something else causing it.
Dr. Powell, I have you seen this booklet, Dr. Powell?
No, I haven't.
Okay, but it lists the course descriptions and the number of hours that psychologists would be required. And I'm wondering if general practitioners would have similar classes that they are required to take.
No, I don't know exactly the content of those. I know the names of some of those courses are similar to what medical students get, which is the first few years of training, which is classroom work.
Right.
So they get classroom work in medications, in physiology, in psychopharmacology, and they do the book work of it. But medicine is not a book work discipline. That is merely background information that is prerequisite to learning how to actually practice and implement those principles in treating of a patient.
I can appreciate that,
okay.
Powell. I guess my question is, I also am a psychiatric social worker,
okay.
And I had my training up at the medical school and also worked with physicians who were in their internship. And it seemed to me that the number of courses that would be required by psychologists and the number of hours is much more than what physicians and general practitioners, at least in my experience, would be required to take.
It lists classroom hours, but only part of medical education is classroom hours. education that is considered central to being able to deal with an individual with a specific constellation of signs and symptoms is the apprenticeship training that takes place on the wards and in the units and in the clinics. Right. So medical students get a couple years in the classroom, then they go out onto the wards where they see patients in a highly structured, highly supervised, patient safety-oriented setting where they aren't making decisions about treatment but are making their own impressions and then seeing how that fits with people who have a huge range of experiences with this. This is a very tightly regulated training system that goes on in the last 2 years of medical school and then an internship where the patient who comes in the door for an intern can have anything. It is absolutely unknown. All that it's known is it's an admission, and then it is up to the team to sort out what it is in a very structured, highly supervised setting. So the patient says what he has, but then it is up to the team to evaluate that. But it is apprenticeship training, so the goal is by the time you've finished that last two clinical years where you've seen lots of patients and had a lot of information from experts about how you respond to those, so you can put some reason to your book learning. Then the internship where it's amazing, perhaps even too rich an experience of numbers of patients, and then a residency, which is 3 years for primary care physicians, with inpatient and outpatient treatment of a whole range of possibilities in a highly supervised setting, so that you take your book learning and learn how to weigh the variables and know what is most likely, and to understand, to get experience with experts as they sort through the relationships between these things. Then in psychiatry, we do the internship where everything comes in the door. Then a specialty in psychiatry. But most mental illness is taken care of in primary care, which is right. That's where most blood pressure problems are taken care of, where most cardiac illness is taken care of. Nurses have...
What I'm asking, yeah. Dr. Powell, is it seems to me that, General, since you make the point,
yes.
70% of prescriptions for mental illness are written by primary care physicians. And it's my experience and my perception that primary care physicians don't get the kind of training that I guess these psychologists would be required to take.
No, they do. In my view, that program that's outlined has in it some academic training, but not the apprenticeship supervised clinical training of a patient comes to you, figure it out, which is the primary care training. And the appropriate, I'd say, training for patients. We don't expect them to know what they have. So it is not that is a that curriculum as it appears does not have in it those years of supervised training in dealing with patients who are that is not.
But this will not just be psychiatric patients. They will be patients across the broad spectrum of medical conditions, and so theoretically, this would be a fairly small proportion of those that would be psychiatric patients. Would you agree?
Well, if 1 in 5 people have psychiatric illnesses, it's pretty much everywhere, and as everything in primary care, you treat what you can, you refer what you can't. But primary care and nurse practitioners and in PAs are much better trained. They've trained in the whole general medical care and are best trained to then, in the context of a general medical problem, they've all seen general medical problems, in a highly supervised training environment, they're much better qualified to single out which specific illness is being presented to them, and then also to know when they've reached the end of their expertise and need to refer. I would be really loath to turn over that sophisticated decision-making to a group that did not have that general medical experience in a highly supervised training system. We're concerned as a society about patient safety and medical errors and whether we need to improve our training standards or where we can look for problems. It doesn't seem like the right time to be handing over a significant part of medical care to people who have actually no training in patient care. We definitely need more nurses. We need more nurse practitioners, psychiatric nurse practitioners. We need to build from the base of the of good training we have and develop expertise. But as one of the prior speakers mentioned, this access problem is really I'm not sure it's expanded to this, but access is a general problem of in medicine in our state, and one that is growing. Oregon Medical Association just completed a survey that I'm not sure you've had a chance to see yet, but we have significant access problems in the state. And I'm not sure we can address it by enlisting, interested parties to pitch in exactly. We need to do some kind of overall fix to that take is mindful of public safety and appropriate treatment and ensuring access to the citizens for all types of medical care and the continuum of care. And this bill doesn't work to that end, but supporting addressing the nursing shortage, the nurse practitioner shortage, and training a lot of primary care physicians trained at a time. We know lots more about psychiatric treatment. We have a lot more medications available to us. Everybody's busy, but dealing with the access problem in the state in an overall sense would probably be the most effective in terms of any single patient population.
Peggy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Annick. I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America, and I will be very brief. I know that I'm opposed to the Dash 1 amendments, and it translates into, I think, increased reimbursement to the private health insurance system. All of you have been participating with Representative Westland's committee and have heard extensive information on the mental health system or the lack of a system in Oregon. I think that that spans both the public and private delivery systems, and I think it's a separate question than from drug prescribing authority for psychologists, and you all know how problematic the access issues are and how difficult it's going to be to sort that out. So I don't think there's any disagreement on that. I also think that another interesting observation that you're trying to wrestle with, and the questions are coming from Representative Tomei and Mona Sanderson, and that is you're trying to figure out whether or not a specific postdoctoral study of drugs is adequate without having the medical training. That's how I see the core of it. But getting specifically back to the health insurance side of it, we've taken a look over the last year in terms of the prescription drug costs and private health insurance, and in every case of the carriers in Oregon, antidepressants and psychotropic drugs are within the top 10 drugs that we spend money on, and there's usually two or three different kinds of drugs that fall into that category. And one of the things we're very concerned about is being able to manage our cost, and for those reasons we're particularly concerned that fully medically trained people continue to be those who are prescribing those kinds of drugs, because we know clearly that a move such as this would have an impact on the costs that we're paying in private health insurance. Thank you.
Question.
Representative Tomei.
Peggy, I'm somewhat confused about why you're opposed to the Dash 1 amendment.
Because Chair Cruz, Representative Tomei, what happens when you expand prescription writing authority to another class of individuals, you will see utilization increase. And the utilization increase in the amount of drugs prescribed would increase the cost that we have to pay for health insurance.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Angela and Sandy.
Chair. Chair Cruz and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm here as a parent and as a member of NAMI. I'm here to register some serious concerns regarding the amendments to Senate Bill 155. I recognize very personally that many psychologists are experts and that there's an overwhelming need for greater access to qualified prescribers. But I worry that the licensure requirements don't guarantee the necessary level of expertise needed to appropriately treat serious mental illness or even know that they're dealing with serious mental illness. In fact, it's the story of my 16-year-old son that illustrates a vast difference between the level of sophistication between psychologists and psychiatrists. At age 5, my son was referred to a play therapist at the recommendation of his preschool. And after a year of looking for signs of abuse and trauma, the play therapist recommended Portland's top psychologist clinic for my son. And I spent the next 6 years and thousands of dollars trying every behavioral management technique known, and those psychologists implored me to be more consistent and implied that my son was simply oppositional and that I needed to be a different parent. Despite their supposed expertise in ADHD and other behavioral problems, they weren't looking for a biological explanation for my son's behavior. In fact, it wasn't until we went to a psychiatrist that somebody believed my son when he said, "I want to be good, I just don't feel like I can, and nobody believes me." And that psychiatrist responded with, "I do, and I want to help." And that changed my son's life. I believe that this doctor's extensive training was critical in differentiating between an obstinate child and one with a complex array of difficulties, including specific deficits in processing speed and sequencing, as well as ADD without hyperactivity and bipolar disorder. And I question whether the requirements are adequate to allow this level of sophistication. And this is critical because even with years of training, it took 2 years of careful medication trials to successfully stabilize my son's disorders. And I believe that the very complexity of my son's disorders illustrates the critical need for deep knowledge of serious mental illness and the profound side effects of medications and their interactions. For example, my son has had invaluable help with the use of stimulants. However, the stimulants can easily destabilize him at too high of a dose. In fact, at too high of a dose, he was intent on releasing all animals in captivity at my local Petco. And on a successful trial of SSRI antidepressants, which enormously helped my son's depression, after a couple of months of success, he stayed up all night painting every inch of his room in a flowing yet pointed manner in blue, red, and yellow, and black. I woke up one morning at 6 a.m. to find him painting a stairwell in a camouflage motif that he had concocted out of cans of paint. This, his psychiatrist determined, was a result of antidepressants triggering mania in him and was helpful in determining that he had bipolar disorder. Next, he was put on anticonvulsants, which is Representative Monis Anderson, I believe, understands is a mood stabilizer. And those require blood draws to monitor organ functioning and blood counts. So those very drugs that are imperative in helping stabilize him require constant physical monitoring. And lastly, he's on an antipsychotic medication. That's been critical in helping him function the way he wants to function. Yet, antipsychotics have serious physical side effects, including significant weight gain that put our children at risk for diabetes. In fact, one of my friend's sons has contracted diabetes, and he is on similar medications. Again, I appreciate the need for qualified prescribers, but I worry that without a solid background in serious mental illness and in the biology of those illnesses, and in the profound effects of medications, I really worry about the risk those who would prescribe would take in diagnosing and treating our children. and I worry about the risk our children and families would take as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sandy Bumpus. I am also here as a parent testifying with some serious concerns about the amendment to SB 155. As I mentioned, I'm a parent. I have a son who is almost 20 years old. He has a diagnosis of schizophrenia, and he was first started presenting problems at age 3. And before I go into his situation, I want to remind members of the committee that basically many of these families are dealing, of us families, are dealing with kids who have very serious illnesses that are considered brain disorders. And also earlier you heard someone refer to families of children in particular as being out of whack a lot of the time, when I would really like to point out that families often with children who have these serious illnesses often do not get enough support or understanding for what they are going through. My son at the age of 3 started exhibiting a lot of serious problems to the point where his preschool also issued some concern. We did not understand what to do. It wasn't until he was age 8, until he was first diagnosed, not with schizophrenia, I might add. At age 7, he was first referred for a psychological evaluation with a well-known and reputable psychologist. And during the interview time that he had with the psychologist, he had expressed some, he said that he got to the appointment by his girlfriend, who was 8 years old, who drove him there in a red Ferrari. And when the psychologist said that that can't be possible because 8-year-olds certainly aren't old enough to have a driver's license, he emphatically stated that that was true and wouldn't back down or say that he was making anything up. In fact, the psychologist reported this story but did not refer my son on for further evaluation. Schizophrenia in particular is a very difficult illness to diagnose, especially in children, and I believe my son at that point in time did not have all the symptoms of schizophrenia to be able to diagnose it, even from a psychiatrist. However, I believe that he should have been evaluated further for what he was experiencing. It wasn't until a year later that he was seen by a psychiatrist, a child and adolescent psychiatrist, who did diagnose him with a complex, several diagnoses. And my son had very good psychiatrists throughout his childhood, and it wasn't until he was really 15 years old that they really began to understand that his illness was schizophrenia. And this happened when my son had a near suicide attempt and needed to be seen right away. He was treated with antidepressants because his depression was very severe, and even those antidepressants did not respond very well. His doctor said that he was glad that my son was no longer suicidal, but my son was still very, very seriously depressed, and that was not good enough for me. In working with this doctor, we were able to determine and understand that he did have schizophrenia. There was a set of neurological testing that was done and that confirmed the diagnosis. And now, because of this, once he began the treatment for schizophrenia, he became better. He started getting better, and today he is very productive. He's getting his life together. He does not have depression at all. Sometimes he becomes depressed over situations that happen in his life, and I imagine he will continue to experience difficulties in his life because of his illness, but he is a much different child today than he was before we were able to get an accurate diagnosis. anyway, in over the last couple of years, I have worked with a lot of families who have kids with mental health disorders. And many of the families, we're talking about kids who are age 3 to, you name it, 18, 19, 20 years old. Many of these families' kids have very serious, very complex disorders. We're not seeing families who have just a child with a simple case. I shouldn't say depression is ever a simple case, but we're not looking at families of kids who have a case of depression alone. We're looking at families who have multiple and very complex situations that they're dealing with their children. And oftentimes we see families who do go to psychologists, and I have a lot of respect for psychologists. But, you know, oftentimes a lot of these families do end up going in to a psychiatrist because they need to have the doctor to have a more clear understanding of what is going on with the child. And you talk a lot about medications, and a lot of the medications we're talking about that treat these disorders, there are a lot of different medications available, and I can tell you that if we had 10 children in the room today with bipolar disorder, those 10 children may all be on different medications because it's just really hard to tell what child is going to respond to what medications. And, of course, in my son's situation, since it took so long to realize that we were dealing with schizophrenia, a lot of the medications we were trying on him for other disorders were not all that helpful. So that's the reason why I have a lot of concerns around this amendment, and I hope that you will take that into consideration as you make your decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Okay. Kathy, could you come up and tell us about the original bill? We haven't heard about it yet.
Yeah. Kathy Mann.
Yes. I thought maybe we ought to have some reference to... Okay.
Good morning.
Morning.
My name is Kathy Mann, and I am currently serving as the interim director for the Board of Psychologist Examiners. I have been an employee with the board for 19 years, and I just wanted to give you a brief statement on the original concept of the bill and why it was originally presented. The bill is necessary for the following reasons. Annual December licensure renewal of approximately 1,100 licenses overtaxes limited board staff for a two-month period, leaving no time to attend to other consumer requests or board business. Changing to a biennial license renewal would reduce the workload by half, placed on the one FTE employee that issues licenses during the two-month period. This concept also makes sense for licensees because they report continuing education on a biennial basis. This is the primary reason for the bill. It was a simple administrative issue just to make the board's office more productive and efficient for consumers and licensees. As far as the amendment to Senate Bill 155 goes, the board has issued a brief statement. The Board of Psychologist Examiners does not have a position on prescriptive authority. If the original bill will not pass because of the amendment, the board requests that the amendment be eliminated and the bill pass as originally submitted. This concludes my testimony. Thank you for the opportunity.
Any questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 155, and I'm going to open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Act 1 amendments to Senate Bill 155.
Representative Tomei moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 155. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections?
Objection.
Clerk, call the roll on the Dash 1 amendment.
Representative Anderson. Nay.
Barker.
Excused.
Nay.
Nay.
Aye.
No.
No. Dash 1 amendments having failed to receive the required majority are declared failed.
Representative Cruz.
Yes, Mr.
Chair.
Representative Westland.
I move the dash two amendments into the bill.
Representative Westland moves a dash two amendment to Senate Bill 155. Is there any discussion or are there any objections? Seeing none, the dash two amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 155 as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And on to Ways and Means, with a referral on to Ways and Means.
Yes. Representative Westland moves Senate Bill 155 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, why is it going to Ways and Means?
Because the member just will have to state this in the Senate floor. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, when the bill moved off the Senate floor in its original form, it did have a fiscal impact of $143,000. So there is a fiscal impact, and it will need to be reviewed to Ways and Means.
Yeah, I think what happened was that the fiscal probably didn't come in until after it was already sent to the floor of the Senate, and so they're depending upon us to send it where it needs to go.
Would that be...
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Isn't this fee-driven? Isn't this psychologists paying for their own services? So it shouldn't really have any general fund.
Well, but if even if it's fee-driven, it has to go to Ways and Means for the expenditure appropriation. And I think that would be a fairly automatic function in Ways and Means.
Any other questions? Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Senate Bill 155 having received the required majority is declared passed. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 155, and I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2889.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2889 was brought to our committee at the request. Primary sponsors of Representative Greenlick and Representative Dalto and several other members of the House of Representatives. The bill is creating a task force on affordable housing for adults with disabilities, developmental disabilities. It specifies the membership of the task force, directs the task force to study and make recommendations on actions that may be taken to address availability of affordable housing for adults with developmental disabilities. It has a sunset date of December 31, 2004, and declares an emergency. It does have a prior reference to Ways and Means.
And committee members, I, at the request of Representative Dalto, who's coming up, I agreed to have this public hearing. We are being very reluctant to create more task force during this budget climate, but we have found that there are other ways to get activities moving and to focus attention on problems, and we're hoping that this will allow that to happen. Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Billy Dalto, State Representative, Oregon House District 21, and I will try to be brief as I think the session has started. You know, we have a problem that is serious for a lot of families here in Oregon, and that is affordable housing for folks, you know, who don't have that many options available to them. And specifically, we have a serious problem with respect to people with developmental disabilities. You know, as we transitioned in Oregon from the way we used to serve folks with developmental disabilities through institutions and transition them into group home settings and into the community, we have involved families more. When those people with developmental disabilities are in the community, and so now as we have folks that with developmental disabilities that are aging, and the families are aging to the point that they're shortly will be unable to care for their children, their adult children, I think it's important that we consider options of how those adults with developmental disabilities can live out their lives in a way with dignity, and
I wanted to bring this bill forward because I think it's important that we start a discussion about options that we have available to us for affordable housing so people with developmental disabilities can not have to worry about, you know, where they're going to live. And so I wanted a task force. I wanted to put together a task force so that we could, you know, bring experts together to start thinking about these measures we could take, active measures we could take to encourage housing development options. There's already a wonderful facility that's being started in McMinnville. The folks out in McMinnville are doing a great job. A nonprofit group is formed, Fulfill, and Families, I think, for Independent Living, and they've started to put money together to buy land and build housing options for folks. And so it's a wonderful group, and I think that we could learn lessons from that development. So I'm just gonna, that's just my introduction. I'm gonna bring some folks forward to talk a little bit to the bill, and then we can bring Mr. Repine forward, and we'll go from there. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Francisco Lopez and Dave Turner.
We'll need it, but we'll explain it on
the way out. Oh. Yeah. You aren't either.
Well, you don't look like Francisco.
No.
No, I'm supposed to be Francisco.
You're Francisco and he's Dave.
Mr. Turner is taking care of the obligations of the city of Salem with making sure he doesn't get a ticket.
Oh, that's always advisable.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I am Bob Lepine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Happy to be with you to talk a little bit about House Bill 2889 as presented by the Representative Dalto. And I know that time is running quickly, so I want to make this as succinct as I can. As the representative said, this is a very distinct population, much different than some of our other DD populations. And the reason is, quite frankly, that they have, in the course of their lives, have been pretty well family-supported to the extent that they have been in residence for most of their child and adult life with their parents. And so in this case, the state of Oregon has been very blessed that we have parents who have taken up the responsibilities of nurturing and caring their children, and now they've become young adults. The concern is, as I've met with this group in the last few months, I've been doing special town meetings with them with similar groups of parents of the same interest to say what are the options out there for housing. It is the fact that the reality is that the parents are becoming older, and their children are because of good health and being able to cope with society and be productive in society, they are managing well. As we all become older, we always start thinking about, you know, what's going to happen to us. In this case, I think the unique piece of this is that the parents are not only thinking about what's going to happen to them as they become older, but they're also saying, as this changes for our life, it has to change for our children's lives, because we may not be able to be here all the time in the conditions that we are, and we need to figure out opportunities or solutions now so they have some certainty as they become aging, as they start aging in place, possibly without the accompaniment of their parents. So I think it's a very important factor. Again, we've dealt a lot with DD populations in the state, but generally we deal with the population where they are under our more specific care and nurturing through facilities or group homes or foster situations, where in this case the parents have really have taken up that mantle for the state of Oregon. These populations, again, are very limited on incomes. They usually have SSI, or they have or are making an income, because most of them are very productive in the communities. But they don't draw a lot of salary, so they have to keep the rents. If they're going to be in a renting environment, they have to be relatively low. Some of them can live relatively independent of their parents. Some of them may still need some assistance on some as-needed basis. And then in meeting one young lady not too long ago, the parents indicated to me that they feel that their daughter would probably do better or well in a group home environment, because she doesn't have some of the other skills that would allow her to be quasi-independent. So this is an issue. We have been meeting with the group, and I've enjoyed knowing them and understanding their issues. And I think the bill that you have in front of them is really their statement of saying it's time for the state of Oregon to give us some consideration. We've been doing the heavy lifting for lots of years here, and can you figure out a way that we can have a comprehensive discussion on meeting the demands for our populations with the constituents at the table, as opposed to government defining and designing what that will look like, really having a serious discussion with all agencies that are invested or stakeholders in it, and parents and guardians that have interest and compassion about what it will be the future for their children. Understanding their resources are limited, you know, I also understand the issues about increasing revenues for more commissions and advisory groups. My pledge to this group has been that we will keep working with them to better educate them, work with them so we can teach them the tools of the housing development, get them linked up with the right partners. But in the spirit of the bill, I think it is it's a discussion that should be had, because you can see the bill indicates that there's literally thousands of these individuals. And we, with our small meetings, we won't reach out and get to the larger group. And if you're really going to have a quality discussion on this, you really need to have more people at the table to really get true representation so all voices are heard on this issue. So I'm here to support the bill. There was a Senate version of the bill that was similar to this. I've supported it also. I've been on record with the applicants that are here with me today of being supportive of this, and so I would add that support at this time.
Mrs. Turner, do you want to read Francisco's statement?
Well, it's rather lengthy. And he asked me to apologize. He had to be in Eugene for an art convention workshop, so he had to leave earlier. But I don't know. You probably all know Francisco. He's so well known around here. He's the executive director of the Child, Youth, and Family Integrated Services Network. And this network is a limited liability corporation formed by three not-for-profit organizations, Catholic Community Services, Shehalem Youth and Family Services, and Rainbow Family Services. And one of the several programs that the Integrated Services Network offers was born out of a settlement in the Staley versus Kitzhaber case and establishes a brokerage where state services are provided with federal financial assistance through Medicaid program. And I think Mr. Repine probably stated pretty much what Francisco wanted to convey. And I know that we're short on time, and I'd just like to add that we joined 13 other families to form a nonprofit corporation called Families United for Independent Living. And this was 3 years ago, and we are now waiting for a loan. We came up with enough money to put down payment on an old house, two-story old house in McMinnville. In which we hope to build eight little separate units for our people with developmental disabilities. Our daughter is going to be 38 pretty soon, and I think she's ready to leave the coop. And we're ready for her to leave. Up until now, she sort of dug her heels in and says, I don't want to live anyplace else. I've got my job, and I want to live at home with my parents. But she's found other interests, and so I think she's pretty ready. And my husband will explain more about what we are, what we're about to do. So,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Turner, and I'm speaking on behalf of my wife Marge and my daughter Teresa, who wasn't able to make it today. We were hoping she could, but she's not able to. Teresa was born with Down syndrome, and she will be 38 in a few days. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of affordable housing for adults with development disabilities. The need exists and must be addressed. There are many reasons to justify that need. I represent only one, but that one reason includes many people. As of January 2002, there were 203 people identified who are living with a primary caregiver who is over the age of 75. My wife and I are in that group of 203. I am 76 and my wife is 78. And while we're in good health, time is not on our side. We are concerned, as I am sure the other 202 families are, about what will happen to our adult children with developmental disabilities after we are gone. The need for a sustainable housing program is there. The need has no cutoff or expiration date. Housing, as proposed by our nonprofit Families United for Independent Living, will not only serve the present population of adults with developmental disabilities, but will serve those families and adults who will follow us. We are not asking for a handout, only a hand up. I ask you, please support House Bill 2889.
Any questions?
Were you going to say anything, Mr. Chair?
Was I?
Yeah.
Yes, I was.
Okay.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you very much. I guess, Mr. Repine, clearly this is in your scope of business, and you're clearly working on it. I'm wondering, you know, in the reason committee that I was reluctant to create task forces is we're trying to find alternative ways to deal with issues rather than impact legislative budget, which was similar to, remember, a few weeks ago when we gave a charge to the folks that were dealing with the runaway and homeless problem. And so I'm wondering, Mr. Repine, if Representative Valto and this group would have the ability to work with your staff to try to come up with the potential of federal funds or other resources we could use to kind of try to address this problem, not necessarily in a formal charge from the legislature, but a charge from the chair of this committee that your department work with the representative and this coalition to try to address this issue. Comments?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, again, being sensitive to the budgetary issues, as I've stated here and earlier, that you know I have committed to this organization to work with them to in this particular group, the smaller group, to address these issues and get them better certified smart, as Senator Courtney might say, so they understand the business they're going to get into, because it is a business, and it's a new environment for them. And they're willing. They have shown true willingness to do this. So, in my business, in our business, the agency, it's our role to do this type of reaching out and helping people who want to be or are considering doing housing as a new entry to serving the public needs. Whether there'll be grants out there and things of that nature, we don't know. I think I would only warn the chair and the committee that and Representative Delto that. I think the bill was designed to be really very inclusive, and I think with the spirit that this group who brought the bill to you have thought about, they didn't want it to be all about them.
Right.
And so there is always going to be that risk or potential that as we start having these discussions, other people from other parts of the state, and your communities particularly, will start saying, well, why them, not us? And when you get to that scale of why them, not us, and that scale gets so large, then the cost issues then become the more apparent. I think on a small scale like this, it's something we can manage. Again, I think it's also very important to have our other partners, Department of Human Services, with us at these meetings, too. And so the bill also gave those kind of directions where we could call upon the people who would also be vested in making this a success. Short of the bill being there and accomplishing that, I don't have any angst or problems with doing that. My only fear is that you will have the communications within the state where they say, well, that group got it. How come they got it? We didn't get it. And so then we'll just have to deal with that if that becomes the process at the end of the day.
Well, it would be the intention of the chair and to charge Representative Valto with overseeing this task. I mean, the purpose of most task forces is to develop a roadmap and to bring back to the next legislative assembly a course of action. And it would be my intention to charge whoever Representative Valto feels needs to be at the table to be prepared to report back to the interim Human Services Committee on the progress, so hopefully by next session we can have something definitive that we can present to the body. And Representative Valto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to check in with the Turners to see that would work for them. You feel like that's something that's an acceptable sort of compromise given our budgetary situation?
Okay. And let me also say that I understand Mr. Repine's position that there are other constituencies out there, but I would also maintain that laying the groundwork for one constituency would probably also give us a pathway to deal with other issues in other parts of the state. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Repine, isn't this similar to what Spark Industries is doing in Grants Pass?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, Correct. The difference, I think, is where you have Spark Industries, which deals with population seniors, people with disabilities, both physical and mental. They are a nonprofit entity who has taken this on as their, without the direct relationship with the immediate family. That is not uncommon in other places in the state. We have a lot of nonprofits who have offered housing or alternative housing opportunities working with the same clientele. The distinct difference with this group is that we have, this is a coalition of parents, not necessarily affiliated with a nonprofit organization that brings the driving force to effect. So it's a little different, distinct. Again, in these cases, particularly for the applicants who are here, these are parents who've had their children living with them all these years, where I think Sparks and other programs similar to Sparks were, are children who have lived in some other alternative form of housing vis-a-vis foster, independent, semi-independent, not with their immediate families.
And I appreciate that. I was just hoping that maybe through the expertise of some of these nonprofits, the parents could see how they can most easily, with this task force or with this group, conquer some of the problems that they face.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, again, that's the purpose of why I've been meeting with their smaller groups around the northwest area of the state is to give them both information and hope for opportunities of how it has been done in other communities, both locally. I've given them some examples of recent ones that we've accomplished within the Lincoln City area. So it can be done. It's just the ability to understand what you're doing and being mindful of what the goal is and the process you have to get there. And trying to put myself in the place of these parents, which I clearly can't, because I think they're just a wonderful group of individuals. I mean, they see this. I mean, I think their risk is they potentially see this could get to be a political or a bureaucratic boondoggle, and they don't have time for that, quite frankly, and I don't disagree with them. I think that's why the emphasis has been on let's get this commission or this task force working to get this thing done, because time's a ticking here. And I don't. These people obviously do not want to leave their daughter in the circumstances that they didn't have some final say-so, and I can't blame them. And I appreciate their position.
Representative Adolfo.
Mr. Chair, thanks so much for allowing us to have this public hearing so we could get together and try to move forward with this. I guess the one point that I would just leave us with is if, Mr. Repine, if you could commit to sort of formalizing in a letter, a commitment for us to work informally.
A formal letter to work informally. That's
exactly.
Good. I like that.
Thank you. But we can memorialize our commitment to the spirit of the task force bill and move forward from there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Delto, I would be happy to, and I think that my suggestion would be is that I would formalize that with the organization has brought forward, at least the starting point, and then include you as being a non-official elected official that will be engaged in the discussion.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, when you get around to setting up this sub rosa group, I would very much appreciate if you, Mr. Repine, and you, Representative Delto, would invite me to participate.
Okay. And just in closing, let me say that this is an affirmative step that doesn't lead this process to the vagaries of the Ways and Means process, which is going to be somewhat speculative this session. Thank you all very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2889, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2165. Colleagues, we're doing this because we need to officially rescind a referral. So the chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that consideration of House Bill 2165 be taken up immediately. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Chair requests unanimous consent that the motion on House Bill 2165 do pass as amended to the floor be paid and be placed on the consent calendar be reconsidered. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The chair would entertain a motion on House Bill 2165 with a due pass as amended to the floor and rescind the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
So moved.
Representative Tomei moves that House Bill 20, that House Bill 25 with a due pass as amended to the floor of the committee, blah, blah, blah. We're going to... Okay, okay. So the motion now is that we're going to send House Bill 2165 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Do we still want it on the consent calendar?
Yes, sure.
Are there any objections to placing this on the consent calendar? Seeing none, so ordered. House Bill 2165, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And we are adjourned. We are closed the work session on 2165, and we are adjourned. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.